Would you give up everything to bring the world information that seems out of this world and possibly crazy? Today we have award-winning reporter, lecturer, and author Ralph Blumenthal bringing us the life of Dr. John Mack. Some may know that Dr. John Mack risked his career to tell the stories of 200 men and women that encountered aliens. Ralph and his latest book, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science and the Passion of John Mack, will bring us the stories and his research of Dr. John Mack. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studio, the one and only Ralph Blumenthal.
That's a great intro, Tony. Thank you.
Hey, Ralph, how you doing?
Okay, great. Thank you.
Well, I'm very excited because a lot of us were thinking in May we were going to get you on, and then there was, you know, this pre-Mercury retrograde, it just communication got screwed up. So apologize for that, but I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, first of all, you know, Contact in the Desert's coming up. This is something that I've participated in for far as I can remember. And it's a great way for people like ourselves to come together and share our stories and experiences and, you know, research. And one thing that you're bringing to the table that somebody that doesn't get to come to contact is John Mack, because he's no longer with us. And before we get into his story, I want to get into your story. I'd like to find out, you know, I've seen a UFO with my family, and a lot of people get inspired by, you know, their own encounters. What's your story? What got you involved in wanting to, you know, look into the research of John Mack? And did you have your own encounter at one time?
Alas, or happily, depending on how you want to look at it, I have never been abducted. I am pure like John Mack was pure. And he also regretted, in a way, not having any encounters of his own, although he later reflected that it was probably good in a way because he could speak as an impartial observer, as an outsider.
Right.
Who was not, you know, trying to validate some experience he had. So either way, it wasn't my choice.
Right.
It wasn't his choice. So I am not an abductee or an experiencer. I was a follower of science fiction growing up. It was a big deal after the war, reading Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, you know,
right.
Exotic voyages to Mars, you know, the moon.
Right.
It sounded so far-fetched. But then I had a whole career in journalism, very earthbound, interests, investigating the mafia and writing about law enforcement,
right.
And Nazi war criminals and stuff like that. Nothing to do with aliens. But I got interested in John Mack when I was a correspondent in Texas for the New York Times, and I picked up a copy of his second book, Passport to the Cosmos. And I was amazed to read that a Harvard psychiatrist, you know, with an esteemed career, mm-hmm. was interested in investigating alien encounters. So I thought, gee, it'd make a great story for the Times. I didn't realize that he'd already been written up in the Times. He was already very famous. He'd been on Oprah. He'd written two books. And then I pick up the paper a few days later and find that he's been run over and killed in London. Mm. He was there for a conference on Lawrence of Arabia. He had written a biography that won the Pulitzer Prize years before. And so he was no longer with us, but I decided to look into his career. I got access to his archives, which his family gave me, full access without any preconditions. Mm. And that was it. So that's how I got interested.
So, first of all, they said they gave you full access, but how was that first conversation? Because I'm sure they were very particular who they gave that information to. What was your convincing words to say, I really want to do a story and do a story justice? Because, you know, a lot of people want to spin it different directions.
Well, the New York Times helped.
Well, true. That is true.
Because it showed right away that I was serious, and I had a track record. I had written, you know, books before, not on you know, alien abduction or UFOs, but I had a track record of writing nonfiction.
Right.
And, you know, this is what journalists do. They convince people to help them. And it wasn't, you know, instant. They thought it over. I contacted them when they were still grieving about his death. It took quite a while. But I think they realized that it was a good match, that I would deliver, you know, a book that I promised, and that I was a serious, you know, journalist. So I think that helped.
So what was the first, I mean, as a journalist, I've never written a book. I've never really pretty much written an article in anything. But where do you start with his story? And how do you, because we've, like you said, he's already been out there and he's already written books. How do you start his story to bring a new kind of light to it?
That is a good question. And that is actually one of the things I'll be talking about at Contact in the Desert. I'm going to do a workshop on the writing of my book, The Believer, in addition to the story of John Mack, which I'll be talking about as a kind of a lecture. I want to talk as an author to fellow authors, because the question you asked is the first question that you know, people who want to write a book ask: how do you start?
Right.
And the answer is it's very difficult, because there's no natural starting point of any book. And by the way, one of the things I'm going to point out is that you don't choose a book; the book chooses you. the topic sort of grabs you before you intellectually decide you're going to write about this. Because if it's an intellectual decision on your part, it's not going to be a very good book.
Right.
It has to be something that really grabs you. So the cosmos reached out, you could say, and grabbed me on this when I picked up, you know, John Mack's book, and I got abducted by the subject.
That's a good way to put it.
So, you know, how do you start? Well, I got the all of his archives were huge, as you can imagine. I mean, he was killed at almost 75 years old. He'd spent his entire career in psychiatry. He'd written books on nightmares and the Holocaust and suicide and all kinds, and Lawrence of Arabia. I said he won the Pulitzer Prize. So there was a tremendous amount of material. Plus, his own therapy sessions, which he taped, where he talked about his own life and his own problems, which he had. Some of the sessions he had with experiencers, abductees, which really were off the table. But so many of them came out on their own afterwards and appeared with John Mack that I got access to some of his work with these people as well. So the big problem was organizing the material. And how do you jump into a, you know, a fast-flowing river?
Right.
Like carefully, very carefully. And believe me, this went through many, many drafts. What I thought was this, you know, one good way to begin it, it turned out not to be. And I'd go back and redo it and redo that and, you know, cut it back. I mean, the thing that every author goes through, it's a really a wrenching process. You know, people pick up a book and think, oh, the author just, you know, wrote it this way. Well, that, what you're seeing is the end product. Anyway, I don't want to, you know, weep and moan about my problem writing the book. I spent 16 years at it, so it was a long time. But what you might be interested in, Tony, is that I decided to start the book with a conference at MIT in 1992 that John Mack co-sponsored. And it brought together atomic scientists and folklorists and psychiatrists, psychologists, religion scholars, because they're all trying to figure out what this abduction phenomenon was really about. It was and remains a complete mystery. It does.
Yep.
That is a spoiler alert that I don't solve. I don't solve the mystery in this book. If you're looking for the answer, don't buy this book.
Right.
If you're looking for a process that, you know, takes you along the path, yes. But anyway, this conference was really important. It produced a thick volume of papers that were released 2 years later, where all these scholars and experts thought, you know, waxed eloquent on what they thought the phenomenon was. And I, that's why I decided to start the book that way. And as a kind of a teaser, and then I go back to his life, and then I return to the conference later.
Do you feel like, you know, I've worked with a lot of psychics and mediums and intuitives. Do you feel that cosmically, universally, that this came to you for a reason to continue his work? Because you don't hear a lot of other people put, I mean, I'm sure there are, but other people that get notoriety and exposure as you have, you know, talking about John Mack's work.
Well, I think everything happens for a reason. I really do. I thought that before this book. I've been very fortunate in my life.
Right.
I've been blessed. I think, you know, like John Mack realized that there is something more to the universe than the reality, the everyday reality we see around us, that there's certain things that we don't understand yet, that physics has yet to, you know, discover. Yes, I believe things happen for a reason, and there was a reason that I was put on this earth, and the work I did at the New York Times, I hope, justifies some of, you know, the effort I put into my life and things I hope I illuminated and made better by exposing, you know, that kind of thing. So, to answer your question,
So when you first got, well, first of all, let's just give a short little description of who John Mack was. For the people out there, they're going, okay, you're talking about John Mack, but who in the heck is this guy?
Right, right. So John Mack grew up in a rather wealthy German Jewish home. His father was a professor at City College, by the way, where I was a student at the time, although I didn't know, you know, I knew who Ed Mack, the father, was, but I didn't have any courses with him. I didn't know our paths would cross, you know, so many years later.
Right.
His father was a professor. His mother died when he was 8.5 months old of appendicitis, which was very traumatic for him and really figures in the book I wrote, because he was searching his whole life for his missing mother. And that probably motivated him in some way to, you know, to go on the mission that he went on. And then his father remarried. He had a stepmother who was also a professor, kind of exacting, and the usual stepmother problems that he had. He went to the movies one night and saw Lawrence of Arabia and decided he was going to write up this amazing character. And spent a dozen years in England and the Middle East writing this book that won the Pulitzer Prize. And then that made him suddenly an expert in the Middle East. And he traveled, to Israel and the territories trying to make peace between the Arabs and the Israelis. And we know how that went. But he tried. He met with Yasser Arafat. And then he got very involved in the movement to ban nuclear weapons, because he was a doctor and he thought the biggest threat to humanity was nuclear weapons. So he went out to Nevada and protested the nuclear test site and got arrested with his family. So all this was very earthbound, earthbound causes, until he went out to Esalen in the late 80s and he got involved in something called holotropic breathing, which was a breathing discipline that helped you change your level of consciousness without drugs, which he had also tried, like LSD, but he was interested in breathing and relaxation techniques. And that opened him up to a whole other world of, what's not within our senses, what's out there. And then when somebody told him that Bud Hopkins, this artist, was investigating alien encounters, he ended up meeting Bud Hopkins through a whole series of steps I outline in the book. He was reluctant at first, but when he met Bud Hopkins, he thought Bud Hopkins was probably crazy, and the people who came to him with the stories were probably crazy. But he quickly realized that these people were not crazy, that something happened to them that could not easily be explained. And he started investigating their stories, and that's what got him going. And then Harvard wasn't very happy with that. Eventually they subjected him to an investigation, which he overcame with no discipline. So that's John Mack in a nutshell.
And what, when John Mack, and he started, did these cases, how did he choose, when you're doing your research, how did he choose the cases that he shared with the public?
It wasn't that easy to find people. Because,
right, I'm sure back then especially.
Yeah, you know, the so-called skeptics, are very glib to say, oh, these people are publicity seekers, you know, they want to tell their story. They don't want to tell their story. By and large, they're ashamed, although they have nothing to be ashamed of, but they cannot believe these outlandish things have happened to them. So they're very reluctant to tell their stories. So it wasn't easy to find all these people. Eventually, they made their way to John Mack because mm-hmm. he became, you know, famous for his research. He settled in his first book, he settled on 13 case studies. Hmm. He interviewed many, many more people, but right. had 13 stories, which are amazing, amazing. And again, I would fault the so-called skeptics and the debunkers for not doing their homework, because you can be a skeptic and, you know, you can contradict, you can, you know, dispute some mm-hmm. of these, you know, encounter stories,
right.
but you got to know what the hell they are in the first place. So it's not enough to say, oh, this is a nightmare. Well, they don't always happen at night. And John Mack studied nightmares and he knew what nightmares were. So these were not, by and large, nightmares, because a lot of them happen in the daytime. People
right.
driving their cars, they're walking in the woods, you know. I got off on a train of thought here, but
that's all right.
Remind me, your question was
how did he choose the cases to share?
A lot of the people came to him. They had bad experiences with other psychiatrists who
right.
told them to take medication, or that they were demented, or that they were just imagining this.
Right.
So they eventually heard about him and they gravitated to him. He had many more cases than he wrote up publicly. Hundreds of cases of people, including, by the way, young children.
Oh, really?
20 years old, who said things like, I fly in the sky, little man takes me up in the sky. So these kids are not, you know, reciting the books they've read.
Right, right.
They're 2 years old, 3 years old. They can barely talk. So that's one of the things that really interested John Mack. But he sorted through these cases and figured out, you know, he had people too who he didn't trust who came to him. He thought some of their stories a little funny. There was one case that hoaxed him.
Oh, really?
A woman came forward with a phony story.
Was this like on purpose or like a journalist or somebody
that? On purpose. And I talk about this in my book. She wanted to expose him for some reason that was never really clear. She thought he was a cult leader and she made up a story. And the peculiar thing is, as I show in my book, she probably was an experiencer because she told other people stories that made them believe, not just John Mack, that she really had experiences of her own. But the one story she told John Mack was fabricated. And he didn't really commit himself, but he thought it was interesting enough. And Time Magazine then used that to beat him up.
Mm-hmm.
And that really hurt him. So you ask how he chose his cases. That was one case where he was a little naive.
I'm sure.
He had to be open to people. You know, that was part of the problem. In order to get them to open up to him, he had to convince them that he was interested in their stories. And his enemies used that to say, well, he encouraged them. He made them believe that their experiences were real. And he bought into their experiences. It was really a subtle line. He had to convince them that he was interested enough that they could open up to him without, feeding into their own ideas. He had to let their ideas be their ideas. He couldn't shape or create. He said at times he was co-creating these experiences, which was a very unfortunate phrase that again came back to haunt him. But generally, I think he kept that line between being supportive and letting them tell their stories.
I guess, I mean, again, as a psychiatrist, and when you're dealing with, and what year was this?
Well, he got into it in the end of 1990. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm sorry, January 1990 is when he first heard about it from Bud Hopkins. Mm-hmm. So within a year or two, he was already deep into it.
So, I mean, even in early 1990s, I mean, if it's 70s, 80s, even 90s, when people talked about UFOs, people always kind of looked at you a little funny anyway. And then when you bring up abduction, then it's, you know, that was a whole different story. I'm curious to how he found his first person to talk about that, and how was he at first not skeptical, but cautious of sharing that to where other people finally heard about him and then started coming to him on their own. But that, how was that first, did you get to read that first case of his, that where, how his thoughts of what this person was going through?
Well, it's hard to isolate it to an exact moment when he, you know, got his first case. I know one of the first people he met was a young man he called Scott in his book, who later came out under his real name, Randy Nickerson, mm-hmm. who actually did a film on one of the strangest encounter cases of all, which took place at a school in Zimbabwe, Southern Africa, where school children saw a landing and two beings, 60 kids. And Randy made a film about it, which should be out at some point, very interesting film. Anyway, so he was one of the first people. There was another fellow that John Mack brought to the Oprah show, Peter Faust, who also came out under his real name, who was a hotel manager. And these people were very brave, by the way.
Right.
Because Randy and Peter did go on these shows with John Mack. John very quickly realized that these people were not crazy. They were not making it up. They were not looking for publicity. He started to eliminate all the things that people who don't know really quickly throw out as, you know, their answer to what this phenomenon is, because I don't know what it is. And John Mack never found out what it is. It's a mystery, remains a mystery, but he was able to eliminate certain things. So the people he started seeing, including these people I mentioned to you, and there was a woman named Julia, who he brought out to, at Harvard, at a very early lecture he gave at Harvard, that these people were completely normal except for this experience. That's what made it so confounding, that there was nothing in their profiles mm-hmm. to suggest that they would be vulnerable to this strange experience. It is not clear why some people had these experiences and other people like me don't.
Right.
It does seem to run in families, by the way. John and others found out that if you had an abduction experience, your parents, mother or father and grandparents probably did, and your children probably did or will. That really is one of the most terrifying aspects. Mm-hmm. You can't protect your own kids if you've had a traumatic experience like this. But anyway, he found no profile of these people that would explain the experience, which is one of the many confounding aspects of it. He wasn't skeptical for long. I mean, he immediately thought that as soon as he saw these people and saw the way they recounted their experiences with suitable affect, which is the psychiatric term for, you know, the way they describe events, you know, their, mm-hmm. their demeanor. It was very authentic. They would weep and cry and curse and you know, they weren't making it up. This is not the kind of thing. He's a psychiatrist. So he says, you know, I know when people are faking. These people are not faking. So,
yeah.
But the answer to your question, it's hard to know, you know, he never found out why certain people had these experiences and others didn't.
So, I mean, we know that Harvard did not, they looked down on this. And how fast did they, because I mean, if you tell a couple faculty members or something and, you know, well, that's kind of interesting. But when did it get to the point where the upper Harvard faculty started looking down upon this and tried to put a stop to it? Or, I mean, what, tell us what happened.
I'll give you a little timeline. So he heard about it the first time from Bud Hopkins in January 1990.
Right.
By December 91, which is less than 2 years later, he was already delivering his first lecture to Harvard. So he didn't too long to try to figure this thing out. You know, he was an impetuous guy. He was very charismatic, you know, tall, commanding, blue eyes, super confident, brilliant as a professional, you know, as a psychiatrist. So he did not lack self-confidence. So, you know, within 2 years of finding out about this phenomenon for the first time and beginning to investigate it, he was already lecturing to Harvard about it. And they let him lecture. There were a few senior faculty members who said, don't be so confident, you know, but they left him alone. Now, 4 years later, in 1994, after his book came out, his first book called Abduction, and he was on the Oprah show and a lot of other shows, and the New York Times wrote him up, that's when Harvard started to get a little skittish and said, you know, we're going to convene and investigate. They called it at one point an inquisition, because they explained to him, this is not an inquisition. So he's a psychiatrist. He says, well, why did they explain it in terms of what it isn't?
Well, I was going to say, they wouldn't even have mentioned it.
Why did they even mention it?
Right.
So I say, yeah, it was kind of an inquisition, because it inquired into his frame of mind, his methods, his finances. It was quite intrusive. You know, did he believe in UFOs? All these things. So it took 4 years for Harvard to really crack down on him. And then the investigation was secret, because it was a personnel matter. You know, and they didn't want, I mean, to their credit, they didn't want to tarnish him with a public inquiry. I think I'm the only one in my book who has the full story of this investigation, because Harvard never made it public officially. They never came out with a report. I pieced it together from reports that the investigating committee made for the dean, and that they furnished to John and his lawyers. So I have the account, you know, pieced together from emails and legal memos, et cetera. By the way, he had two crackerjack lawyers. He had Danny Sheehan, who had investigated the Ku Klux Klan and Karen Silkwood case and Iran-Contra, the arms scandal under the Reagan administration. And then he had Eric McLeish, who really is credited with investigating the priest scandal, priest abuse scandal in Boston, right at the same time. He just started that when he started working for John Mack. So Mack had super lawyers, and they held Harvard's feet to the fire. And they made Harvard, you know, forced Harvard to try to, you know, come up with something substantial against them, which they never could do, really.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We got to promote our, I can't believe it's only a week away, Contact in the Desert. The 25th through the 28th, only a week from today. And Ralph Blumenthal is going to be there, and he's going to be doing a lecture and a workshop. When we come back, I'm going to ask if Ralph actually got to meet or speak with any of his former patients. So don't go anywhere. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told, and get your questions ready in the chat room.
When you start to ask the question, it unfolds. the fabric of space itself, how it's made. What is it made of?
We're not alone in this universe. We never have been.
Alien intelligences have cohabited with us on this planet for millions of years.
We inherited the obsession from the Anunnaki.
Anyone that still thinks that we're the ones that are obsessed with gold does not know enough about the true history of our species, how we came to be here,
and the conditions that brought us here.
We are not unique in this universe. Extraterrestrials do exist. We are, so to say, the copies of them.
All right, we're back. I'm Tony Sweet with Ralph Blumenthal, and next week is going to be Contact in the Desert. Yes, it is online. It's virtual this year, but you should get your tickets today because they're going to go out fast, and we hope you all enjoy next week's speakers. I mean, there's tons of them. Let me just see if I think I have a picture. There's just a few, not only Ralph, but, you know, George Norrie, Nick Pope, Linda Moulton Howe. The list goes on and on and on. And Ralph, you're going to be there, and you're going to be getting more in depth on what we're talking about today. And I mean, what are you going to be showing? Are you going to do some presentations, pictures? I mean, what are you going to show?
Yeah, I'm basically going to be talking about John Mack. I gave you, you know, sort of the flavor of it.
Right.
A lot of the people there will know who John Mack,
right,
you know, was, but hopefully I'll tell some stories people haven't heard before and talk about his life and how he really pointed the way very courageously for a Harvard psychiatrist to take on a subject like this. And then that'll be called In the Footsteps of John Mack. And then I'll be doing a workshop called, I forgot what the lecture might be called, Impossible Yet True. The quote abduction of John Mack, because he was never abducted, but he was abducted by the topic.
Right.
Which is the point I want to make.
And the workshop is In the Footsteps of John Mack.
Okay, that's the workshop. and the other is Impossible Yet True. I forgot which. But anyway, the idea in the workshop would be to talk about it as an author approaching the subject and how do you get your arms around a thing like this, especially for a New York Times reporter who spent his whole career, right, you know, investigating very, you know, earthbound subjects. suddenly I'm, you know, off on UFOs and alien abduction. But it's the same process, you know, you collect the facts, you stay out of the way, let the facts speak for themselves and tell the story. So I'm really looking forward to this conference, even though it is unfortunately virtual, there will be a live Q&A.
Oh, that's so great.
Ask questions and I can respond.
I love it. I love we were talking that, you know, I'm a person, I like to feed off the crowd. I like the live aspect. I love to see face to face with people. And I'm sure you do too, especially the enthusiasm of people that are in the same right of mind as you, you know, UFOs and aliens and all that good stuff. So get your tickets. The lecture's included in the past, but the workshop is additional, but it's going to be well worth it. Like I said, there's going to be stories that he's going to tell that you won't get to hear here. And I'm sure other interviews that he's been on, but, I'm curious. You had access to, you know, through his family, his the case files and stuff, but did you ever get a chance to speak with some of his patients?
I did, quite a few of them.
Oh, great.
And some people who didn't actually see John Mack. By the way, he couldn't, nobody could ever decide whether these were patients or subjects, because a patient really has something wrong with him.
Right.
And John said, there's nothing wrong with these people except that they had this traumatic experience. So it's not like they were suffering, you know, some ailment. So they're not really patients. And he was also researching the cases. So in a way, they were research subjects, but they were a little of both. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one good example is a woman who's known to us now as Linda Napolitano, who was the subject of a whole book by Bud Hopkins called Witnessed, because she was seen by some witnesses levitating or being flown out of her 11th floor window over the Brooklyn Bridge by three beings into a spacecraft that flew off and plunged into the East River. And this happened, I believe, in 1989, according to, you know, the story that Bud Hopkins told. So I had the chance to interview her about her experience. She's a very otherwise normal person with a great story and able to tell it herself very lucidly. It's a famous case, probably one of the most famous cases in ufology or the annals of alien encounters. The problem with the case was that Bud Hopkins never could identify the two witnesses who came forward in the first place, security guards, apparently for a VIP, who was later identified as Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, who supposedly witnessed this as well. He died just last year at 100 and never really talked about it,
right,
although he was offered the chance. But anyway, I've talked to Linda at great length, and Randy Nickerson, who was one of John's first experiencers, and a whole bunch of others. Karen Austin, who joined up with John later in his life and helped him run his household, became very outspoken. Reached out to Lawrence Rockefeller, who was a great benefactor of John Mack, one of the billionaires who supported his research along with Robert Bigelow. I did get to meet them myself and ask them my own questions and determine, although I'm not a psychiatrist, that they seem eminently sane, and except for what happened, except what they remembered happened to them, let's put it that way, they were completely ordinary.
Was there any from the time that John Mack interviewed them, as a study case, to the time that you spoke to them, did they have any new abductions or new encounters that after his passing?
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
Many of them continued to have experiences. It's not the kind of thing. I mean, it did come in certain irregular patterns. And, each case was a little bit different.
Right.
But many of the people I spoke to and people who John Mack didn't work with because they came along much later, more recently, tell me they continue to have experiences. And they never know really when they're coming. They might drop off for a few weeks or months, and then they come back. And by the way, one of the things that John Mack found so interesting is that while there was a general consistency to these stories, there was a basic abduction story. Beings would they'd see a spacecraft. Beings would appear. People would find themselves in a spacecraft for different medical procedures, pseudo medical procedures, reproductive procedures, experiments. Eggs would be taken from women or sperm from men, and then they would be reabducted later and see their hybrid offspring. That was sort of a common theme, but the stories were really within that very often very different, and some didn't involve spacecraft at all.
Oh, really?
Some just involved strange beings. Carrie Mullis, a Nobel Prize winning chemist who wrote a book, he died just about 2 years ago, very eminent figure in science, had an encounter with a raccoon that spoke to him. No spacecraft, no aliens, just this raccoon. And then he found himself on the road, the next morning, and he didn't know how he got there. So the experiences are really, they run a gamut. And it's really very, very strange. The more I looked into it, the more John Mack studied it, it was very hard to characterize. And very hard to you know, jump to a conclusion and say, well, this is clearly this or that.
Right.
It's fascinating.
Well, it sounds like with the raccoon, that sounds like Garden of the Galaxy. Yeah. I'm curious, was there a main theme? I know, you know, abductions, but was there a main theme of people saying, okay, I've been abducted, but they told me about the future. They told me why I was abducted. Did they have an enhancement in intuition? What was the changes that they saw spiritually and mentally, not just physically?
Well, John Mack, by the way, was sort of unique among researchers in this field, in that his people, the people he worked with, told him that they had experienced some spiritual growth as a result of these experiences. And other researchers, notably Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who was a historian who did some very interesting work with his own circle of experiences, had a rather different take on this. Hopkins and Jacobs did not get the same impression that there was this spiritual growth involved. But in John Mack's case, people told him that they emerged with greater concern for the fate of the planet, worry about pollution of the planet,
right,
nuclear war, the terrible things that are going on Earth, and a feeling of love sometimes for these beings, an attachment to them, a feeling of love for this spirit of the cosmos, this permeating benevolence of the cosmos. This sort of tempered the trauma of the experience, which was undeniably traumatic.
Right, I'm sure.
To be taken, immobilized, and to feel powerless and see these, you know, beings of various types, not just the so-called grays, but taller figures and reptilians and, you know, a whole slew of races, according to some of these people. It's not just one kind of being. Anyway, that is scary.
Yeah, it would be.
So in addition to that, these, as I said, these people felt that they had come away with something, and it was not just a terrifying experience. It was moderated by this insight that they felt they had gotten.
Was there any feedback or resistance from the U.S. government towards John Mack at that time, or have you had any, you know, contact with, because there's a lot of information coming out now with the U.S. government intelligence agencies about UFOs. I mean, have you had any encounters, or did John Mack have any encounters with the U.S. government?
John Mack did not. He was asked about that specifically, and it might be sort of counterintuitive. Again, we stick to facts. People who love to dabble in conspiracies, much prefer to hear that John Mack was abducted by my lab, you know, the military abduction arm of the government or whatever, you know, the way the stories go, and subject to, you know, mind-altering torture. Not true in his account. He was asked about it. He said the government never contacted him in any way, never obstructed his work, which is interesting. Because it's a fact,
right?
We deal with. Neither have I. In my work at the New York Times, I have reached out to many government people. I didn't always get the information I wanted. Very often, I didn't. But we at the Times developed some good sources who eventually were all on the record. We didn't use any, you know, deep background, unidentified sources in our stories, and it was pretty straightforward. They told us what they could.
What they could.
Some stuff was classified, which we were never able to find out about, such as recovered materials from crashed spacecraft, supposedly, which there are a lot of stories about, but we were never able to really nail it down. That's probably one of the biggest outstanding mysteries with UFOs. Does the government possess, you know, materials, and are they using them to reverse engineer, defense equipment, et cetera? We don't know. But to answer your question, no, I've never been interfered with by the government. They've never tried to plant disinformation on me. Right. What I did find, by the way, is interesting that we came across some documents that seemed highly interesting about crashes.
Oh, really?
But it was not clear that the documents were completely authentic, that they may have been tampered with or adjusted to be partly true and partly fake. They were tainted in some way, we concluded, and to the point where we couldn't rely on them.
Right.
So the government has a long history of, you know, putting out disinformation.
Right. And, to throw you off the scent.
Yeah, throw people off the scent or try to discredit people looking into this. They try to say that early, you know, people studying UFOs were communist sympathizers.
Right.
They try to question their loyalty and really terrible stuff. But so it is interesting that in some particular cases, documents we thought we could rely on had some doubt about them. And in the end, if they have a doubt about them, we're not going to write about them or feature them because we don't want to be caught, you know,
right,
for something that is in some way bogus. So anyway, and, you know, the government may have tampered with these documents in order to see where leaks are.
I'm sure.
Throw adversaries off the trail. You know, maybe the Russians and the Chinese were working on stuff, so we're going to feed them a fake document. So who knows?
Well, we just have a few minutes left. I mean, the book, The Believer, please purchase this book. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to RalphBlumenthal.com. But is there enough case studies or other research of John Max to make another book, or is everything in this one?
Well, I'd like to say everything is in this book. first of all, his archive is huge and voluminous. And it is not public yet. The family has not, the John Mack Institute, let's say, which with his legacy and the family has not put these documents out yet for public research. When they are put out, I'm sure there's stuff there. I know there's stuff there that I haven't dealt with. That would be very interesting to scholars. So I would welcome, I'm not proprietary here. I don't want to say, nope, I'm the final word. And nobody else can write about John
Right,
Mack.
Right.
I welcome further research. So there is more material here. I like to think I skimmed the most important parts and, you know, the main part of it. But he's a fascinating character. What's not in my book or anywhere else, public certainly, are the actual interviews he did with many of his experiencers. Now,
oh,
when they came out later publicly, that's public. When they
that's
were on
great.
TV shows with him, that's public.
Right.
But when he interviewed people in you know, therapy sessions or counseling
mm-hmm.
sessions, those are obviously confidential. And some of those people have never come out under their real names. So they would not be happy to know that this material is out there. Even under a pseudonym, it's not out there. So that material will probably always be confidential and probably should be.
All right, last question. Very important question here. Going in as a journalist, you know, I've known a lot of my friends that were journalists. They go into like a story as a journalist, kind of mid-ground, believer, not believer. But after researching and studying his cases, were you a believer before? And if not, are you a believer now?
Well, first of all, I like to say, and I actually put this in the New York Times, that I don't like the term believer. I use it in the book because I say John Mack was a believer in earthly justice and
right.
being courageous and pursuing, you know, the question. But it's often used pejoratively, like you're gullible, you're just a believer. And first of all, UFOs are not a question of belief. We now know they exist.
Right.
They are physical. They've been tracked by the Navy and radar,
mm-hmm.
and imaging devices, and pilots have seen them. So, you know, you could ask, well, do you believe in the moon and the star? Do you believe in the sun? Do you believe in the ocean?
Right.
So, you know, yeah, I believe in UFOs because it's not a question of belief. So that's one thing. Now, again, alien abduction is such a complicated question. These accounts by people who are otherwise eminently sane have no easy explanation. The obvious things are off the table. They're not crazy. They're not, you know, hallucinating. They're not making it up. They're not seeking publicity. You know, for all the reasons I said before, the obvious explanations don't compute. So what's left, we don't know. It's a mystery. Hopefully science can come to the rescue, because we investigate everything else. We send radio signals up to, you know, through the cosmos,
right,
to look for a response. We look for the dark matter and dark energy of the universe, 95% of which is a mystery. We look for hidden particles that make up, you know, the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
We look for all kinds of things, spend billions of dollars. And this is what I end my book with, the story of how we spend all this money scientifically to try to get answers, but we're not spending the same money to try to figure out what's going on with these people.
Isn't that true?
So that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the answer is, but we need to keep looking for it.
Well, Ralph, thank you so much. This has been great, and I've really enjoyed having you on the show. And I can't wait to next week for your workshop and lecture. Please come back, and we'd love to. There's other books I'd love to touch on, because you've written so many. And congratulations on a great career.
Thank you, Tony. Real pleasure to be with you. Thanks
you
for having
it.
Me.
And everybody, thank you for joining us every Friday and supporting us, sharing our show, commenting. We appreciate it. YouTube, subscribe, iHeart, Apple, all that. Subscribe, leave some positive comments. Those are always the best. And until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Don't go anywhere, because I have another interview right after this.